When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's a summer's day in 1879. We're not far from the historic town of Santillana del Mar in Cantabria, northern Spain. This is a land of green vegetation, rolling hills and lush meadows, though in places the terrain rises sharply, forming rocky outcrops. There are caves hidden in the hillsides. Here and there, narrow gaps in the rock hint at the vast depths within. Two figures are making their way along a path. A balding, middle-aged man with bushy sideburns and an 8-year-old girl with short cropped hair. Marcelino Sanz de Sauteula is a local landowner. Like many 19th century gentlemen, he's well-educated. He's a man of scientific interests and consuming passions. In particular, he's a keen amateur anthropologist. On a recent trip to Paris, de Sauteula paid a visit to the Universal Exhibition, where he was excited to see a display of prehistoric tools discovered in French caves. These discoveries have given him an idea. Perhaps there are similar items in the cave on his own land. De Sauteula has decided to take a closer look. Naturally, his daughter Maria is tagging along on this particular day. As an only child, she's always been a daddy's girl. They reach the mouth of the cave. De Sauteula lights two charcoal lamps and hands one to Maria, her eyes widening as they focus on the flickering flame. De Sauteula settles down to see what he can find around the entrance. If this cave had ever housed prehistoric occupants, this is where they would have made themselves at home. It's the brightest part of the cave and the best place to build a fire so that the smoke can escape. De Sauteula scours the ground, looking for objects like those he saw in Paris. Meanwhile, Maria ventures deeper inside. The light from the entrance fades quickly as she walks further into the long, narrow chamber. She becomes more and more reliant on the glow from her lamp. She is totally absorbed in the novel surroundings and sensations. The cool air, the echoing sounds, the opaque darkness. But what lies unseen beyond the small circle of light cast by her lamp? There, above her head, emerging from the gloom, she sees smudges of colour, red, ochre and black. Her eyes widen to take it all in. As she stares more closely, she realizes that the smudges are animals painted on the rock. They seem to come alive in the shifting glow from her lamp. Maria runs back to the entrance, calling out excitedly to her father, "Look, Papa, there are oxen!" De Sauteula smiles indulgently. He follows his daughter back into the interior of the cave to see what has fired her imagination. Then he holds up his own lamp and sees them. Bison and red deer, boar and horses, herds of incredibly lifelike animals roam across the undulating plains of the ceiling. De Sauteula is astounded. As well he might be. What Maria has found in the cave of Altamira are the first cave paintings ever to be discovered in Europe. Until this point, no one knew that prehistoric humans decorated their homes in this way, let alone that they could paint with such extraordinary skill, artistry, and colour. These prehistoric artworks caused a seismic shift in our understanding of prehistoric man. But they also raise an interesting question. How did our ancient ancestors paint such detailed works in the pitch-black depths of caves? How could they depict such detailed and lifelike creatures with no natural light? Now, you might be saying to yourself, they built fires, of course, but there's a problem with that theory. Soot. If the prehistoric occupants of Altamira Cave created these artworks to the light of large open flames, traces of soot would be everywhere, dirtying the walls and ceiling and obscuring the paintings. So how did they do it? Well, the answer to that question is what we're here to talk about today. The prehistoric people who painted the cave at Altamira saw their creations in the same way Maria and her father did millennia later. They used lamps. That's right. Sometime around 40,000 years ago, our ancestors figured out that if you burned animal fat in a stone receptacle, you could have light without too much smoke. Hundreds of these primitive lamps have been found at archaeological sites across Europe, and they're especially common in caves containing prehistoric paintings. The lamp was a staple of our homes long before we even lived in houses. For tens of thousands of years, we humans have wanted to keep our dwellings well lit at night and stave off the encroaching darkness. But it's more than that. Lamps have also enabled artistic expression and human creativity. And in the 36,000 years since someone first painted a bison on the ceiling at Altamira, lamps have continued to serve both our basic needs and more self-indulgent desires. I'm Ruth Goodman. I've spent my life exploring the extraordinary history of everyday items, the little things that we often take for granted. You see, every object in your home has a fascinating hidden history, a story that's just waiting to be told. In this episode, we'll be diving into stories of the ingenious ways people have lit their homes throughout history. So come along with me, and together, we'll explore the curious history of your home. For thousands of years, humans used lamps that were essentially the same as those found in prehistoric caves. But in the Bronze Age, things began to change. Ancient societies all over the world started to experiment with different kinds of oil lamps and with more efficient types of fuel. In ancient Egypt, they learned to use castor oil rather than animal fat. In Greece, the favoured lamp fuel was referred to as liquid gold by famous poet Homer. In a verse composed sometime in the 8th century BC, the author of the Iliad and Odyssey described how the hero Achilles was washed down by fair maidens. And what were they smoothing into his skin? Olive oil. The burning of olive oil for light, plus improvements to lamp design, led to changes across ancient Greek and then Roman society. It impacted everything from domestic life to theatre, religion, and beyond. The Romans created even bigger, more elaborate oil lamps, which they used to illuminate their homes, shrines, bars, baths, and the gladiatorial contests that took place after dark. And oil lamps even played a part in death. They were buried with the dead to light their way into the afterlife. But after the end of the Roman Empire in 476 AD, people started to light their homes in another way. One theory is that the fall of Rome disrupted the trade in olive oil, forcing northern Europeans to find another source of light. Candles. The age of the candle in Europe didn't exactly burn brightly, but it did flicker on for centuries. The light it provided was dim, uncertain, and above all, expensive. In Britain, candles lit our way through the Middle Ages and into the Tudor period. What comes to mind when you picture a home in this era? Do you see a cosy little cottage, brightly lit by gentle candlelight, a roaring fire merrily crackling away in the centre of the room? If you do, you're not alone. But the scene you're imagining is not the whole picture, because whatever some movies might have you think, Tudor England would not have been lit in glorious technicolor. I can tell you that at night, Tudor homes were dark. But what about candles, you might be wondering? Well, candles were expensive in this period, prohibitively expensive, in fact. Just one good beeswax candle cost fourpence, the average daily wage for a labouring man. Imagine spending £85 to £100 today on a light bulb that might only last a day or two. There was another option for ordinary people, and that was candles made of tallow or animal fat. But these yellowish-brown candles smelled awful, and they produced a lot of smoke. And they were still expensive. A day's wages would only buy you two candles. So if the average person had to light their home after dark, they turned to something called rushlights. Now, I've spent months living as a Tudor, both as a reenactor and in a television programme called Tudor Monastery Farm. I've made many a rushlight in my day, and it's pretty simple. You take a rush, usually you can find them growing near a pond or a ditch, peel off most of the outer rind and dip it in a bit of leftover animal fat. This will provide you with about 45 minutes of rather dim light. All in all, they're pretty rubbish. So rather than spending an arm and a leg to light their homes, or fiddling with smoky, inefficient rushlights, a lot of ordinary Tudors simply went to bed when the sun went down. Henry VIII could keep feasting through the night, but not the average worker. This might sound strange, especially in the winter months when the sun sets much earlier, but it's incredible how quickly your body adapts. After just a few days living as a Tudor, I quickly fell into a natural dawn to dusk rhythm, growing sleepy as the sun began to set and waking up when the first rays of light shone in through my window. The average person lived like this for centuries. Unless, of course, they had a job that meant they had to work late into the evening or early in the morning. But at the start of the 18th century, the wealthy had found a new way to help light their homes at night. Mirrors.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's February the 25th, 1745, and we're headed to a costume ball. The party in question is being hosted at the Palace of Versailles by King Louis the 15th himself. It's his famous yew tree ball. Now, officially, this soiree was thrown to celebrate his eldest son's marriage to Maria Teresa Rafaela of Spain. But the real purpose of this extravagant event is far more salacious. Louis the 15th, you see, is on the hunt for a new mistress. He has his sights set on Jean-Antoinette Poisson. She is young, beautiful, and married. Louis has organised this masked ball so that he can mingle with her incognito. The party starts at 11:30 p.m., an absolutely unheard of hour normally. I mean, it's pitch black outside. But the yew tree ball is not taking place in a normal setting. It's being held in Versailles' Hall of Mirrors. Let's head inside. This place is truly fit for a king. The marble walls are covered in gold leaf and scores of crystal chandeliers drip from the ceiling. Masked servants weave through priceless golden statues. The whole scene is watched over by paintings of Louis's great-grandfather, Louis XIV, the Sun King himself. Hundreds of revelers surround us in ever more elaborate costumes. A magician sips champagne with a sea monster. Harlequins dance with Greek goddesses. Death himself nibbles on a canapé, scythe in hand. The doors open, and 8 men dressed as yew trees enter. But which one of the leafy gentlemen is the king? It must be him, flirting with Jean Antoinette, herself disguised as a pretty shepherdess. But even more impressive than the opulently dressed guests or the grand hall is just how bright it is in here. Thousands of candles twinkle atop the chandeliers and candelabras. But they are not solely responsible for this effect. They are aided by the 357 mirrors lining the wall, reflecting their flames. People have used reflective surfaces for thousands of years, mostly as grooming tools. Polished surfaces made of obsidian, dating back around 8,000 years, are the earliest mirrors in the archaeological record. Later civilizations, like the Greeks, used small discs of polished metal. These surfaces might work for fixing one's hair, but they're not going to light up a room. From Roman times, people knew how to make glass mirrors backed by a thin film of lead. But the process of applying hot lead to glass was tricky and only produced very small mirrors. Then, sometime in the 14th century, a breakthrough. A technique was perfected that allowed metal to be applied to glass without heat. By the 16th century, the city of Venice held a monopoly on mirrors, and they guarded the secrets of their trade jealously. But they were ultimately helpless to stop artisans moving in and out of the industry, and soon their method of mirror making got out. These brilliantly reflective surfaces were soon all over 17th and 18th century Europe, literally lighting up the chateaus and villas of the wealthy. Special mirrors that featured candle holders embedded in the frame became popular amongst the elite, and people began experimenting with convex mirrors that could reflect even more light. Of course, not everyone could afford this luxury. Using expensive mirrors to help light the average home at night simply wasn't feasible. Normal people were still largely at the mercy of the rising and setting of the sun. That is, until two inventions born of the Industrial Revolution came along and changed everything. It's 1802 and we're at Soho Factory on the outskirts of Birmingham. It's a massive building nestled within rolling hills, a tranquil setting disrupted by the racket coming from behind the factory walls. There are furnaces roaring, watermills churning, and steam hammers banging away. Inside, workers scurry about assembling a dizzying array of products, including jewellery, candlesticks, buttons, and decorative boxes. The Soho Factory is an epicentre of the burgeoning Industrial Revolution, and the brains behind it is an entrepreneur named Matthew Boulton. Boulton was a powerhouse of innovation. His factory was one of the first in the world to use assembly line manufacturing, more than 100 years before Henry Ford, and he was an early pioneer of mass factory production. He also had a keen eye for opportunity. His greatest moment came when he met James Watt, the famous inventor known for his steam engine. Boulton provided the money and factory space for Watt to build his engines, and as well as using them to improve his own production, Boulton was soon selling them to other industrialists. The Boulton and Watt steam engine helped kickstart the Industrial Revolution, forever changing the world as we know it. But Boulton also played a key role in another world-changing invention. artificial light. In 1783, a Swiss inventor named Ami Argon moved to England. In Paris, he had struggled with people pirating his invention, a new kind of oil lamp. He hoped that Britain's copyright laws would protect him. In 1784, he managed to obtain his desired patent. And who was there to help him manufacture his invention? Matthew Boulton. The two went into business together that same year. The argand lamp featured a circular wick that could be raised or lowered, housed within two concentric tubes. And it burned 10 times brighter than a candle, far brighter than any lamp in human history. Unlike candles, this lamp was actually bright enough to comfortably read, sew, or cook by. Homes across Britain, and soon the rest of the world, eagerly adopted this new form of lighting. But the supremacy of argand's oil lamp was short-lived. Within a few decades, it was supplanted by another invention, the gas lamp. Now, gas lighting was to have effects far outside the home. It would change the world of work, and in lighting up the streets, it would change public life too. Once again, there's a connection with Matthew Boulton, because we owe this invention to one of his most trusted employees, an engineer named William Murdoch. In 1779, Boulton sent Murdoch to southwest England to oversee the assemblage and installation of steam engines in Cornish tin mines. Tin and Cornwall go together like bread and butter. Well into the 20th century, it was Europe's largest tin producer, and the region has worn this crown for most of recorded history. But when you have got mines that have been in use for several thousand years, you start to run into problems. By the late 18th century, the mines had started to flood. People tried all sorts of methods to get the water out. But Boulton and Watt's steam engine proved to be the most efficient. Overseeing these machines kept Murdoch busy during the day. By night, he had other interests. Murdoch was an inventor in his own right. He was always tinkering with Watts's steam engines, and he was particularly interested in the gas produced by burning coal. Murdoch figured out that if one could capture enough of this gas, it could be used to fuel more than just a lamp. It could light up a whole home. So he built a closed iron vessel in his garden shed where he cooked coal and found he could light a flame with the resulting gas. By 1794, he devised a system to pipe it into his home, and his house became the very first to use gas lighting. Murdoch took his new invention to Boulton, certain that he would use this new invention in the Soho factory. He resisted at first, but by 1798, gas lighting was being used to light the main building. In 1806, other factories began introducing Murdoch's invention too. Gas lighting had arrived, and it caught on like wildfire. For the next 50 years, it was mostly factories and other large-scale workplaces that turned to gas light. The increase in working hours that this made possible gave businesses an enormous boost. And as gas lighting became more widespread, this unnatural light was brought into our homes as well. In 1846, Prince Albert had gas lighting installed in some areas of Buckingham Palace, and soon middle-class families were adopting the new technology too. But gas lighting was far from perfect. Gas lamps were quite a bother to light, so they were only lit when someone wanted to stay in a room for some time. For short-term and emergency use, people either moved around in semi-darkness or used candles. They also created unpleasant fumes, blackened walls with soot, and of course, there was always the risk of explosion. So although oil lamps and gaslight transformed our relationship with darkness, there were shadowy corners we couldn't yet illuminate. That all changed when electricity burst onto the scene. It's the evening of April the 16th, 1849, and we are in Paris, a little over a year after the revolution that ushered in France's Second Republic. The city is enjoying a semblance of normality. Violence will flare up again soon, but for now, Parisians saunter down the street, joyfully taking in the crisp night air. Opulent carriages carrying revellers trundle down the cobbled avenue, leading to the city's Grand Opera. It's a splendid building in the neoclassical style. Two enormous gold statues flank the entrance, and the facade is swathed in gold inlay that shimmers in the moonlight. Inside, the theatre is hushed. Finely dressed ladies and gentlemen settle back into plush red velvet seats, waiting for the third act of Giacomo Meyerbeer's new opera, La Prophète, to begin. This is the event of the season. Napoleon III himself is there, along with composers Berlioz and Chopin. So far, the audience has been dazzled by incredibly designed sets and a newfangled roller skate ballet. But the best is yet to come. The enormous chandeliers that hang above our heads have all been extinguished. The audience waits in the pitch black with bated breath. Suddenly, a light appears behind the stage, blindingly bright and rising, just like the sun. It's so bright, the actors on stage look like mere shadows in comparison. Within minutes, the whole room is flooded with light, as though the sun really has appeared in the dead of the Parisian night. The audience is taken aback. It's like nothing they've ever seen before. And they never have seen its like before. This is one of the first times that members of the public have experienced the awe-inspiring power of electric light. The illusion of the rising sun in La Prophète was created by what's known as an arc light. Now, arc lights were nothing new in 1849. They'd been invented by Humphrey Davy in the early 1800s, but they were just too impractical. There was nothing wrong with the lights themselves, but the only source of electricity in the first part of the 19th century were inefficient batteries, so powering them became incredibly expensive. It was only in the 1870s, when more efficient electrical systems were instated, that arc lights were adopted for street lighting and the occasional large building. But there were other problems with arc lights. They had a tendency to flicker and hiss. In 1899, Hertha Ayrton became the first woman ever to read her own paper before the Institute of Electrical Engineers, when she gave a talk explaining this phenomenon. And they were also very bright, far too bright to light small spaces like the average home. So the hunt was on for an electric light suitable for domestic use. This many-horse race took place over the course of decades, but at the finish line, it was neck and neck between the Brit, Joseph Swan, and the American, Thomas Edison. Working entirely independently, they both patented incandescent light bulbs in 1880 on their respective sides of the Atlantic. What ensued was a bitter rivalry. Edison ended up using his vast fortune to sue Swan, claiming that his light bulbs infringed on Edison's patents. But the case never came to trial. Before it could, the two inventors decided to join forces, and in 1883, they founded the Edison and Swan Electric Light Company. Together, Edison and Swan could effectively suppress all other competition in Britain, which they did. Despite the bulbs being entirely Swan's design, Edison, shameless self-promoter that he was, continued to push the narrative that he alone was responsible for the creation of the incandescent light, a myth that persists to this day. In the following decades, incandescent lighting swept the globe and soon became our main source of light. The last of the shadows had been banished. Now, Electric light might seem completely run-of-the-mill to us today, though we've already seen that it has a long and exciting history. But let's think for a moment about the early adopters. Electric light completely changed how we exist within our homes. It allowed people to move more freely at night. It allowed us to continue socializing, eating, reading, and playing in comfort after dark. It was even one of the factors that led to more individual privacy. No longer did families have to huddle together in one room at night like they did in the era of gas lighting. Now they could spread out and spend time alone in their individual rooms. But electric light has changed more than just the way we live our lives. It has changed our bodies too. We've all heard that overhead lights, mobile phones, laptop screens are disrupting our sleep, and there's a good reason for that. Candles, oil lamps, and gaslight slew towards the yellow end of the spectrum. Electric light is significantly more blue. Blue light is found naturally in the sun, but also in LED lights, phones, and laptop screens. While blue light boosts mood and alertness during the day, it is detrimental at night. You see, human brains rely on light exposure to distinguish times for waking and sleeping. At the end of the day, when it's dark, the brain knows to secrete melatonin in order to fall asleep. Blue light disrupts this pattern, meaning the brain struggles to distinguish whether it's time to sleep or wake up, and so melatonin is not released. But there is a bright side to all this light. Compared to humans in the past, today we get to choose how bright our homes are. We never really have to be without light unless we want to. We can read books that we just can't put down late into the night, walk the streets more safely, enjoy long evenings with friends and family, or simply scare away the monsters hiding under the bed. Artificial light has given us unprecedented power over our own lives. How we choose to use it, well, that's up to us. In the next episode, we uncover the murky history of washing up. A high-stakes meeting between the kings of England and France leaves behind a mountain of dishes to wash. Our need for soap wreaks havoc on global ecosystems. And the inventor of horrific weapons of war turns his hand to more domestic pursuits. That's next time on The Curious History of Your Home.